Good evening and welcome to the March 2026 edition of Outbeat News in Depth. I'm Greg Morelia. Well, March is Women's History Month, and we're celebrating with two guests tonight. First, Finn Dearhart shares his conversation with Ray Stovey, author of several young adult novels. And then in the second half of our show, Raif DeRozzi talks with Dr. Amelia Rock about her work looking at how social determinants impact the HIV epidemic. So stay with us. It's all coming up next, right after your Outbeat Radio news for this Sunday, March 22nd, 2026. This is Greg Morelia with your Outbeat Radio news for the week of March 22nd, 2026. Russia's campaign against LGBTQ plus rights organizations is escalating. Just days after a St. Petersburg court secretly banned the advocacy group Coming Out, the first documented case under Russia's 2023 Supreme Court ruling that designated the so-called international LGBT movement an extremist organization, a second case has emerged. Ardian Fokin, the director of a grassroots group called Irada, meaning rainbow in English, was found guilty by a court in the Samara region of organizing an extremist organization and evading so-called foreign agent duties. He was fined the equivalent of approximately $5,700. A lawyer with a Russian human rights group called this the first extremism case brought against the leader of an LGBTQ plus initiative, describing it as part of a new state campaign to ban and criminalize organizations previously labeled as foreign agents. Russia's anti-LGBTQ plus legal framework has been building over a decade. It began back in 2013 with a ban on sharing what the government called propaganda of non-traditional sexual relations with minors. In 2022, that ban was expanded to cover all ages, effectively criminalizing any public expression of LGBTQ plus life, in person, online, or in the media. And in Europe, a landmark decision, the European Court's Court of Justice, has ruled that all EU member states must allow transgender citizens to update their names and gender markers on official identification documents. The ruling came in a case brought on behalf of a Bulgarian transgender woman who lives in Italy, where she has begun hormone therapy. Bulgaria's 2023 Supreme Court decision had banned transgender people from updating their documents, a policy the EU court found to be in direct violation of the fundamental right to freedom of movement guaranteed to all EU citizens. The court stated that a mismatch between a person's lived gender identity and the gender data on their official documents creates real and concrete obstacles in everyday life, from visiting a doctor to paying by card to finding employment, enrolling in education, and securing housing. The ruling applies to all 27 EU member states, including Hungary, which similarly banned transgender people from legally changing their gender in 2020. Advocates are calling the decision an important step toward establishing the right of legal gender recognition across the European Union, something the United States might want to take note of. And here in the States, in the state of Idaho, the House of Representatives have passed a measure formally requesting that the U.S. Supreme Court overturn its landmark 2015 decision in Obergefell v. Hodges, which established the constitutional right of same-sex couples to marry. House Joint Memorial 17 passed by a vote of 44-26. The measure argues that Obergefell, in its words, is at odds with the Constitution, claiming that the court applied a definition of liberty that would not have been recognized by the country's founders. Notably, three more Republican lawmakers voted against the measure this year compared to a similar resolution that passed in 2025. One Republican substitute representative, Grayson Stone, cited the Bible as the reason for his no vote. He acknowledged that the position might amount to, in his words, political suicide. Another Republican representative, Mike Pohanka, said that while his personal religious views on same-sex marriage has not changed, he represents all of his constituents and did not want to cause unnecessary hurt and pain. The measure now moves to the Idaho Senate, which declined to take up the vote last year. Even if passed in the Senate, the resolution would not legally compel the Supreme Court to take action. And in South Minneapolis, a 30-year-old sexual health educator named Albie Sanchez spent 2 weeks afraid to leave their home. Sanchez, who identifies both as queer and a Mexican-American, is a U.S. citizen, but the visible presence of Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers in their neighborhood made even a trip to the grocery store feel dangerous. Sanchez's story reflects a growing public health crisis. Since ICE's operations began in Minneapolis back in December, an increasing number of Latino patients have been delaying or canceling HIV prevention and treatment appointments. This is particularly alarming, given that in 2023, Latino Americans are 72% more likely than the general population to be diagnosed with HIV. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moralia. Our first guest tonight is Ray Stovey, an author of young adult novels including Work Case Scenario, The Summer Love Strategy, Arden Gray, and Between Perfect and Real. This month, Finn Dearheart had a chance to sit down with Ray and talk about her work.
Welcome to Outbeat News. This is Finn Dearheart, and I'm super excited today to be interviewing Ray Stovey. Ray is the author of the young adult novels. There's a lot of them, so maybe get out your pen and pencil. Worst Case Scenario, The Summer Love Strategy, Arden Gray, Between Perfect and Real. They also contributed to the young adult anthology Take the Mic, Fictional Stories of Everyday Resistance. They received a Made at Hugo House Fellowship and created the young adult YA/MG Trans and Non-Binary Voices Master List, a database that tracks all books in those age categories written by trans authors about trans characters. When they're not writing, they can be found gardening, making art in other mediums, or hiking in their beloved Pacific Northwest. Welcome to the show, Ray Stovey. I'm really excited to talk to you about your craft, your works, all the really awesome stuff that you're up to, and perhaps I will feel inspired after talking to you to go get busy with my own writing today. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I know I always feel inspired after talking to other writers too, so yeah.
Seems like you've written so much already.
Yes, yeah. That was... the first thing that I wanted to be when I was a kid was actually an author. And so it's a dream come true to be able to put so much of my work out into the world.
That's incredible. So you knew early on and you just followed that path. Is that how old were you? Do you remember?
It was the classic age where like every adult is asking you, like, what do you want to be when you grow up? So probably like eight or nine. Actually, though, my life took some turns along the way. You know, I think in this culture, we kind of grow up hearing that we need to find a job that will support us financially and that, you know, artistic careers aren't reliable. And so that's often relegated to like a hobby or kind of a side thing. And so, you know, I did the kind of classic like early 20s food service thing, and I worked in education for a little while, but writing was really the love that I kept coming back to.
Do you remember what you wrote about first? I'm curious, like those little inklings.
Yeah, totally. So I was a huge like sci-fi fantasy fan as a kid and still am today. And so a lot of it was just like my own kind of made up worlds. Anytime we had a class assignment where we were allowed to be creative, I would just like make up a story. So yeah, just like fantasy lands where, you know, like quests and talking animals and all that jazz. Yeah.
Well, I love what you're bringing in because the imagination is like, I agree. Like we're conditioned to think that is the realm of this special category called the arts. And if you are lucky enough to be, you know, skyrocketed into that field, then good for you. If not, it's just a hobby, like you said. And, but I also would say furthermore, the imagination is a contested space where we, as queer people carve out a sense of meaning and have a lot to share. And I'm curious what you have to say about imagination as a contested ground.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. Yeah, I think like the imagination is a space where we can sort of be and do whatever we want in a way that we can't in real life. And that was definitely what it was for me as a kid. You know, like one of my favorite series in elementary and middle school was Tamara Pierce's Alana the Lioness series, where this girl trades places with her brother and pretends to be a boy so that she can become a knight, and then ends up becoming the first woman knight of the realm. And for me, like growing up, assigned female at birth, that was like the first inkling that I had of like, oh, you can do something outside the norm. And I think fantasy and genre fiction in general is often seen as like frivolous, but I actually think it's possibly like one of the most powerful mediums out there, because there's just so much more space and expansiveness to explore.
I 100% agree, and I love what you just shared about that inkling that you had based on this the imaginative trail that you followed. Yeah, it's weird how, I mean, people don't walk around and think that we're living in an imagination state all the time, but I think as again, are you do you identify as queer orientation?
Yes.
Yeah. So I lump you into my category here, but like as queer people, I feel like there's this way that we've grown up on the outside and have suffered a lot because of that many times. I'm generalizing, but we've been ousted. But then there's this like perspective and vantage point that we have from the outside looking in, and then all these people walking around that have no idea that they're living in imagination state all the time about everything, about gender, about meaning, about their realities and lives. And you're snapping. You can't see, listeners, you can't see, but Ray is snapping right now. And so yeah, I just as a writer and as someone who's in that space and working in that medium with minds and hearts and bodies, I'm curious if you have anything to say about that as a queer person looking into this culture who doesn't really imagine that they are imagining.
I think that's something that I just have always treasured about being queer. And it's why I use the label queer itself to refer to my identity. I've explored, like, I came out as bi in high school, and then for a while I was like, maybe I'm a lesbian. And then I was like, no, I think like queer is the word for me, because it implies not only like like your sexual or romantic interest, but also a positionality toward the world of questioning the norms and designing your own way of living. And that's something that I love about being queer, is that we get to look in and say, like, does this even work for me? Like, what if I did it this way? And that can be hard when you're growing up without models, but it's also very like freeing as an adult to be like, actually, like, all of this is made up. This is all an imagination state. Like, we decided that it had to be a certain way, and I can do it different.
I'm curious how you're navigating these particular times, given all the attacks on trans people and queer people, and like what that kind of what that's bringing up in your process as a writer and as a creative and just as a being.
It's really hard to be trans writer of young adult fiction, particularly right now, because several of my books have been banned and challenged.
Really?
We have now this national book banning bill proposed that would position my work and the work of many of my friends as, I forget what the wording is, but just like inappropriate in some way, as being, pornographic, which we know is not, like, that's just outlandish, and we're like really trying hard not to curse
I know. I would
right
totally
now.
hear you. Yeah, I got in trouble last month for that.
And
It's
it's
not, I
funny
haven't
because,
baited you, by the way. I'm not trying to bait you into cursing.
no, don't worry, it's all good. It's just like the natural response, right?
Totally.
And it's funny because the first four books of my career have been contemporary YA, like set in the real world, very much about queer and trans teenagers figuring out who they are, and all the other fun stuff that goes along with that. I think more and more as a writer, I'm actually finding refuge in turning to fantasy and sci-fi, as well as the romance genre, because I think I don't know, they just give you the ability to have a sense of hope and like imagine a world where things like integrity matter, where things like love matter and can be like the central influencing force in someone's life to like a positive end. And where people can, you know, maybe face really hard things, but in the end, they come through it. I think that's like the power of fiction in any genre, is that we can read it and we can have like a somatic and an intellectual experience of having gone through something and coming out the other side. And I think right now we're like in the thing. And I think art can help us imagine like getting through that to the other side. Does that
I
make
love
sense?
it. I love that. Yeah, well, I mean, this might be in a different direction, but touching what you're saying, there's this let's say like you brought about the somatic process and the reader going through that. And there's a writer that I've loved named Lydia Yuknovitch, who had said something somewhere that I've just quoted so many times about how in writing, like she knows when she's done what she wanted to do when she brings the reader into her body. And a lot, because in that way, we're not like explicating what we think, but we're actually like sharing what it is that we're feeling and experiencing such that another person can enter into that space. And it makes me think about you and your characters, and I wonder about these characters about whom you've been writing and exploring through fiction. Are they like, what aspects of you and what parts of you are we getting to kind of like snuggle up to and have an experience with if we read these books?
Totally. Yeah, that's just making me think of I did my launch for Worst Case Scenario recently, and you know, many of my friends came, and one of them, like somewhat jokingly but seriously, asked like, which of your characters is most of a self-insert for you? But yeah, all of my characters do have a piece of me. I think, you know, between Perfect and Real, which is about a closeted trans boy who gets cast as Romeo in the school play, is very much the part of me that I was in theater in high school and really wanted to play male roles. And for me, it was Mercutio that I really wanted to play in Romeo and Juliet. But that really came out of imagining, you know, what would it have been like if I had gotten what I wanted in high school? And what would that have opened up for me? You know, Arden Gray, the main character Arden, and then Worst Case Scenario, the main character Sydney, I think they both contain the parts of me that are really prickly, that are very like, cranky, and afraid, and like, you know, kind of some of the mental health struggles that I've been through with, you know, Arden experiences depression, and then Sydney is has undiagnosed OCD, which they sort of figure out in the course of the book. And then Haley, who was the main character of Summer Love Strategy, I honestly, in some ways, she's like the least like me, but I think that she has this sort of like bubbliness and the part of me that is maybe most like idealistic and in love with the world.
It's so cool. I imagine that like young people reading your books do get the opportunity to have their imaginations opened because of this, and maybe thinking about themselves in this way of multiplicity. So important.
Yeah, that's what I always hope for, and has always been my goal to write queer and trans characters that aren't just like whatever the main stereotype is at the time, but are just full individuals with many other things to them in addition to that.
The recent novel, the no, what's the name of the recent one again?
Worst case scenario.
Worst case scenario, yeah. What about that novel do you feel like is contemporary with your own process right now as you have just put this out? How do you smile at this question?
You know, it's funny because I just sent out my most recent newsletter talking about actually how difficult the process of writing Worst Case Scenario was. Not really primarily because of the mental health content, but more because it sort of like made me re-examine like what my purpose was as a writer. And what I wanted to be putting out in the world. And I really struggled to write the book and realized kind of halfway through writing it that it wasn't the book that I wanted to write.
Really? Wow.
But I wrote it anyway, and it turned
Yeah.
out really well. It's gotten 2-starred reviews, and it's, I don't know, it's interesting. I think the title is very, like, very relevant to what's happening in the world today, but also relevant to what Sydney goes through and kind of what I went through, which was like, oh, this is worst case. Like, not worst case, but like, this is not a great situation for me as a writer to be having to write a book because it's under contract that I don't feel connected to.
Wow.
But through the process of writing the book, I came to really love it in a way that is different from my other books, in a way that I feel just more like, because I learned so much from writing it, I feel attached to it in a different way, if that makes sense. And I think it
That's like
really,
making you stretch, right? Like making you
yeah.
stretch out, yeah.
And it made me like realize and sort of rededicate myself to like, I need to write what I feel most called to write. You know. Yeah, there's a lot more that I could say, but I'm aware that we have like time constraints, so.
Oh, well, I mean, we're doing great on time right now. I mean, if you want to share more, I'm really intrigued about that. Like, because it, like, this book, it sounds like it made you have to work in a way that didn't feel maybe as intuitive, and that you had to really discipline yourself into. Sounds really hard. I mean, as a writer myself, I just kind of feel like, wow, that you're really dedicated, and like, how does one do that?
It definitely felt like sort of just like dragging myself along at points through the mud. But I think it also taught me to value revision even more because I actually love revision maybe even more than drafting because when you have the book, you don't have to like write the whole book. It's not sitting there in front of you, but you can shape it. And you can turn it into what you really dreamed that it could be, and you can bounce it off of other people. And that was where I started to see, like, oh, wait, this isn't as A, bad as I think it is, because I'm a perfectionist. And B, there is merit here. And there is, even if I am still finding my way to feel connected to it, other people will feel connected to it. And the revision process sort of brought me into understanding it and loving it on its own terms.
I love revision too, by the way. What
Oh,
do you like? Like,
awesome.
it's like, as you describe, like having it out in front of you, and you just could kind of play with the structure and arrangement. How do you, I'm curious about your actual writing process. Like, how do you, because everyone does something different, and there's always like best advices from people that are just kind of like, I'll try them, and I'm like, this is bad advice for me. What works for you? Like, what do you do that helps you stay on the heat point of what you're processing and experiencing, and then being able to produce material that you're proud of?
I love your phrasing. Yeah, I think finding what works for me has been really important. You kind of start out with ideas of what a real writer does. But, you know, mine was I get up at 5 a.m. and I write for 8 hours straight like it's a 9-to-5 job and like that doesn't work. And most of us are not doing that. But for me, also, music is a huge part of my writing process. So I make playlists for all of my books of what, you know, the songs that speak to the story, what I think the characters may be listening to. And for me, that's a very visceral way that I can get into the world like almost immediately. And often these playlists, I will play them in the background over and over because I kind of have that ability to, I don't need a word of music. And so it just becomes part of like the texture or the atmosphere of the world. It's like when I hear this playlist, it's almost like a Pavlovian cue of like, now I'm like in this world. And then as far as like my process, so my first book was completely like the first draft was completely pantsed, like completely just, I just wrote it with no planning, no strategy, no like real, I didn't know what I was doing. And then since then, I kind of have a process where I will typically think of a sort of pitch of the book, and then I will do a very vague like outline. And then sometimes I'll do a more detailed outline, but often I will start working from the outline that I have or the synopsis sometimes that I've written. And then as I go, I find that things come up and things have to change. So I will alter the outline according to that. So it's a little bit of like, I need the structure. Otherwise, I get like, totally freaked out by the task in front of me and like don't know how to make it come to fruition. But I also need to be able to have the organic, like, discovery process that is like just so essential to the experience for me.
Oh, it's so cool. Thank you for sharing about your creative process. For some people, that's such a like, I'm gonna guard this, but I really appreciate hearing how you're digging into those spaces. And I hope that creative people out there listening are inspired by your process, your work, what you're doing, who you are. Is there anything that you want to add before we conclude about what we talked about here, or just some message to potential readers or our Outbeat listeners?
Well, firstly, shout out to the Bay Area. One of my best friends lives there, so I've gotten to visit and I love it. But yeah, I think just the message that I try to impart in my work and to readers is just that I think that your story matters. And if you're a
Totally.
writer or an artist, or even if you're not, whatever you have, like you have something to put in the world that matters. And so do that thing.
Totally. I 100% agree, and I really appreciate you saying that. Okay, Ray, it's been so awesome to connect with you. Thank you so much for sharing. Where else can people find more about your work, and how would you like them to contact you?
I think the best places for that are my website, raystobey.com, and then I also have a newsletter which you can find on my website. I am trying to detach from social media, so while you can find me there, the best place to get like what I'm really thinking about and what is going on with my work is my newsletter.
I love that. Yeah. So if you're listening, sign up for Ray's newsletter. And thank you so much for coming and speaking on Outbeat.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll be back with more right after this.
Wanna lock in your love.
That, of course, was the amazing Sam Smith with his song Latch. Sam just finished up a residency opening up the newly refurbished Castro Street Theater. And I can tell you, having had the privilege of watching his concert, it was pretty amazing. And if you're just joining us, you're listening to Outbeat News in Depth here on KRCB Radio. I'm Greg Moralia. Well, earlier this month, as part of Women's History Month, we shared a story on Outbeat News about the alarming rate of new HIV infections happening in women. There's a lot to unpack behind this statistic, and this month, Raef DeRozzi had a chance to talk with Dr. Amelia Rock to discuss her work addressing social determinants that impact the HIV epidemic.
Amelia Rock has studied and promoted sexual and reproductive health and rights for 20 years, specializing in HIV prevention and treatment in gender-based violence. She researches how structural and social factors, namely stigma, gender and sexual norms, economic opportunity, criminalization, and community solidarity affect people's health and rights, and uses this knowledge to influence programs and policies. Amelia works in Latin America and the Caribbean, Southern and Eastern Africa, and the U.S., in collaboration with sex workers, LGBTQ plus communities, and others experiencing social marginalization. She was a postdoctoral researcher in the epidemiology department of Johns Hopkins University and a program implementer and evaluator at John Snow, Inc. Currently as principal consultant at Amelia Rock Consulting, LLC, she partners with community-based organizations, international and advocacy NGOs, funders, and academics on research, evaluation, and programming to advance public health and social justice. Amelia, how are you? Thank you so much for joining.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
I'm so happy to have you. It's been a journey trying to get our schedules to mesh, but yes, we finally made it.
We did. Here we are.
So I'll start by asking you a very broad-based question that I ask a lot of my guests, which is, what is your perception of the current global HIV/AIDS epidemic?
Okay, so what is my perception of the HIV epidemic right now? I think it's sort of an impossible question to answer, but I'll give it a shot. I think that we've seen immense improvement on so many indicators, so many measures that we care about. The length and quality of life among people living with HIV has increased overall. The number of new infections in many settings has decreased. So at that sort of very broad macro level, I think there's a lot of progress. That said, disparities in every direction, disparities between countries, disparities between world regions, disparities within countries and within cities, from one neighborhood to another. For example, in Washington, D.C., where I live, you see radical disparities in the prevalence of HIV, the proportion of people who are living with HIV, access to care and treatment. You know, I imagine many of your viewers are well acquainted with the disparities that we face in the U.S. with regard to PrEP access, right? So pre-exposure prophylaxis for HIV prevention. That said, there have been some really, really exciting advances, you know, both in terms of both biomedically, meaning both in terms of the kinds of medications and treatments and approaches to delivering those treatments that have become available. You know, the injection for PrEP, for example, is being scaled up more and more, and that's really exciting because we know that there are now studies showing that there is a huge measurable benefit to people having multiple options in terms of the type of PrEP that they have access to, for example, the oral PrEP, the pill, versus the injection, versus vaginal ring. So just having that choice and also the ability to change, that itself really seems to increase the extent to which people can use PrEP as they wish. And so there's a lot of really exciting developments too.
Your focus is on structural and social factors that influence HIV and HIV risk and treatment and care. And there's a lot to unpack in what all of that entails. can you tell me a little bit about how you got into this work?
Mm-hmm. When I started my career, my grown-up work life, professional development, I had a desire to work on social justice issues in some capacity. I was particularly interested in reproductive rights, in women's health, which at the time, shall I age myself? this was a while ago. You know, women's health strictly meant cisgender, basically heterosexual women's health. So I ended up starting work as a data clerk at the University of San Francisco, at UCSF, in a what turned out to be really amazing research group. It's called the Women's Global Health Imperative. Women's Global Health Imperative subsequently, some of the folks stayed at UCSF and some moved over to RTI, Research Triangle Institute, but which is just to say that they continue to do awesome work. And the key thing about this work that was what really hooked me in and was the start of my career in public health and a public health career oriented towards social and health equity is that the work that they were doing, it was clinical trials of HIV prevention methods for women to use for heterosexual women to use that they could theoretically use without the agreement of male partners. So at the time, the language of female-controlled methods of HIV prevention was popular. I don't hear that as much these days, I think, because there's been recognition that it's more complicated than that. There, you know, when you're using an HIV prevention method involving two people's bodies, you're never going to have something fully, or in rare cases, you're going to have something that's going to fully be under the control of one person, particularly if it requires the other person's body to be used. But the focus of that study, the focus of the work of that research group was on this intersection of gender and economic deprivation and HIV risk. And looking at, we didn't call it the social determinants of health, but it was a social determinants of health sort of framework underlying the study, meaning there was an understanding that gender norms, gender inequity, and women's economic strain, women's poverty, were driving women's HIV risk. And for example, by inhibiting their ability to ensure consistent and correct use of condoms. So that sort of social, that orientation towards the social factors, the non-physical factors, the social inequalities and how they create HIV risk, that was formative for me. And that is a thread that has continued throughout my career, whether I've been working on HIV or other health issues.
And earlier you mentioned that there are radical disparities, mm-hmm. specifically in DC, that you've noticed access to care and treatment. Can you speak to that a little bit?
I can. Impressionistically, I don't have statistics in front of me, but you know, maybe I'll look this up after we talk. You know, I recall a map of DC that, you know, simply shows by color the different areas, different neighborhoods, and the proportion of people in those neighborhoods living with HIV. And not just living with HIV, but I believe that the maps of, you know, people living with HIV who are accessing ART also look this way, where you can just see, it's just so clear with the colors that, you know, the areas with more people living with HIV are also, you know, the areas where people are facing greater economic exclusion, you know, racialization, these different factors that we know can be associated with increased risk of HIV and more difficulty accessing preventive and treatment resources.
Okay, so you've mentioned social determinants of health. I'm betting that a lot of people have never heard that term before, or maybe those who have don't know exactly what that means. And I know this is another big question to have you answer, but can you tell us what does that mean and how does it impact the HIV epidemic?
Yes. The social determinants of health are the attributes of our environment that influence directly and indirectly our health. And these are the factors outside of individual behaviors, outside of the things that individuals directly control that influence our health. So for example, you know, the terminology, you hear different terminology used: structural determinants of health, social determinants of health. I tend to say structural and social determinants of health. It really just relates to how close or far from the individual you are. So for example, an example of a social determinant of health might be norms, social norms around, let's say, gender, right? And so it's acceptable or not acceptable. It's more or less acceptable to need and seek healthcare, depending on whether you present as a man or a woman. So for example, you know, due to sort of norms around masculinity, those kinds of norms that sort of say that, you know, men have to be sort of, you know, strong and not need help, might make it hard for men to go to a clinic to get tested for HIV, for instance. So that's an example. Another example, you know, we're talking about, so anything in our environment, right? So that can be like social norms, that can be housing, how available good, safe, secure housing is. That can be the physical environment or the built environment, as some say, so meaning how many parks are accessible to a person based on where they live. Are there parks? Are the parks safe? Because that
And how does
can...
something like mm-hmm. parks in a neighborhood, how does that connect with our health and in our HIV transmission rate?
Yeah. So that example, I was thinking of it more in terms of how that connects to exercise, people's, how easy or difficult, you know, many different things influence how easy or difficult it is to get exercise on a, you know, on a regular basis, right? And one of them is, do you have a place to exercise, right? So it could be park, could be, I don't know, safe streets. Let's just go with safe streets for walking, right? If you don't, if you can't go outside and be safe, you're going to walk less. And that can contribute to things like heart disease, right? It can also contribute or risk of heart disease, right? How likely you are.
And maybe folks have heard of the term food deserts, where
totally
the ability to find quality grocery stores with healthy foods is just lacking, and it's mostly fast food shops. And
exactly.
So the health outcomes as a result of that are, you know, pretty self-evident.
Yes, exactly. And just to sort of bring it back around to HIV, you know, there can also be mental health impacts, right, of living in a place where the streets aren't safe, right? That can lead to anxiety, depression. And we know well that mental health, that anxiety and depression can be big barriers to accessing HIV treatment and to taking HIV treatment in the way that allows it to be effective or to be adherent as. Sorry, and the food desert thing. Sorry, that's also relevant to HIV, right? Because, you know, the mental health thing, but also, you know, my understanding is, you know, as with many medications, you want to take them with food, right? And you want, and in eating healthily, healthy diets are important for staying well, you know, for anybody, but, you know, including for people living with HIV. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, you mentioned comorbidities, and a lot of comorbidities they're not absolute in their risk potential. And a lot of our lifestyle and our health and our diet impacts directly the chance, the risk of having these comorbidities as we grow older, as long-term survivors living with HIV. So a lot of these, I guess what you might consider like general things that help support our health definitely apply to people living with HIV.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And based on your work and what you've seen, is there a need for different or multiple different approaches based on whether it's in the US or Latin America or sub-Saharan Africa?
Based on my work, so how much does sort of context and the specific characteristics of different contexts, how much does that matter for what?
For an effective strategy to ending the HIV epidemic?
I think it's, how do I say this? It's of utmost importance. I think taking context into account and making sure that strategies related to HIV, whether it's to help people use HIV prevention methods, whether it's to help people be able to get their medication more easily, those, you know, HIV treatment, HIV prevention, those interventions are only going to work in the real world if the nature of the real world that people are living in is taken into account. is reflected in the design of those interventions, of HIV treatment services, for example. It's critical. We've learned this, and by we, I mean the broad world of HIV research programming and policy. We've learned through so much research from so many failed and not failed and successful programs that people's real lives, the worlds that they're living in that so strongly influence what they can and can't do, must be taken into account. And that when we don't take people's life circumstances and contexts into account, that that, you know, programs and interventions are much less likely to do any good for anyone. We've learned this so many times, and yet I think still, you know, speaking of what do I perceive of the HIV epidemic, you know, and yet still, you know, you see a lot of, you know, service delivery and work being done that still doesn't sufficiently take into account people's lived experience and the places where they live and where they're coming from and the particular barriers or, you know, and that they face and the things that help them about their context. So I think it's critical.
Yeah. I like what you said about the word determinants in of itself and how it really just gives you the feeling that to say that something is determined means that it's a fixed outcome. it's going to happen.
Exactly.
So just even on a subconscious level, like to hear that, you're thinking, oh wow, okay, this is what it is for me. It's set in stone. But you know, I did an interview last year with Dr. Eric Verdin at the Buck Institute up in Northern California, and he does a lot of research on genetics and aging. And it reminds me of what I would call genetic determinants of health. Even on a genetic level, they're not fixed. Totally. It's malleable. You know, you can switch on and off genes based on your behaviors, on your diet, on your physical activity. So, I mean, if even on a genetic level, we have so much control over the majority of the outcomes of our health, then on a social, you know, social one, I would imagine that that would also apply. And you're talking about probability and statistics. You know, probability and statistics aren't helpful on an individual level, and they're not meant to be applied to the individual. They're it's just a general overview of a population. But as an individual, we can't look at a probability and a statistic and assume that that applies to us, and that we have to say, okay, I am 75% likely to accidentally walk off a bridge. That's not how it works.
That is really important, and that is very true, because you as a person, you have so many different qualities of yourself, of your life, of your world, of that are playing into that.
Exactly. Once you know what those determinants are, what those factors are, then suddenly you have the ability to make conscious decisions regarding that or about that. So if you know that I have that there's a statistic that in this town, 75% of people will walk off a bridge at some point on accident, then maybe I won't walk on bridges, or maybe I will carry a flashlight at night, or use the handrail or something like that. And then suddenly you've put the power in your hands.
Yes, totally. I think that's
terrible analogy, but humorous.
No, I think it's simple and it's great and it's clear. And I think, and also having this knowledge, having this better understanding of these powerful social and structural policy environmental factors, it can also light the fire, right? I mean, you know, once, you know, you're totally aware of how these, you know, how different kinds of inequity, you know, these environmental factors are affecting certain communities and the injustice there, I mean, that can spur organization, it can spur connectedness, you know, it can spur the work. And so, yeah, doesn't have to be depressing.
That's such a good point, because you can feel so ambivalent or powerless sometimes going through life if you're just like, you just have this general sense of unease or like difficulty, and you can't quite like figure out why. Like, why is life so hard? I don't understand. But then once you start understanding, oh, you know, I don't have a farmer's market in my neighborhood. I don't have a library I can get access to. Public transportation sucks. Every park I go to is trashed and dirty. And like, I'm starting to understand the things that are like impacting my ability to have success and whatever that means to me. And once you see that, then you go, okay, it's not a me problem. I don't just hate life, but there are things that can change and need to change. And like you said, it might invigorate you in that way, or it can. And one would hope that that would be the reaction versus just kind of saying, my situation is horrible and there's nothing I can do. All right. Well, I have so much in my notes that I wanted to cover, and there's so much more that we could talk about. And I would love to have you back on if you're open to it, to Absolutely. Kind of talk more about what these social determinants are, maybe talk about sex workers as it relates to HIV as well. Amelia, thank you so much for hopping on with me and really diving deep. This was a good conversation.
Thank you, Rafe. It was great to talk.
Thanks, Rafe. Be sure to tune in next Sunday night for Trans Forum with Del Phoenix. That's at 8 p.m. and only here on KRCB Radio. In the meantime, have a fantastic week, and thanks for spending your Sunday night with us. Outbeat News in Depth is hosted and produced by Greg Moralia. Our shows are available for on-demand play anytime on our website at outbeatnews.com and on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, and now on iHeartRadio. Find links to subscribe at outbeatnews.com. I'd love to change the world, but I don't know what to do. So I give it up to you. You're broken down and tired of living life on the merry-go-round, and you can't find a fighter, but I see it in you, so we gon' walk it out. Move mountains, we gon' walk it out and move mountains. And I rise up, I rise like the day. I rise up, I rise unafraid. I rise up, and I do it a thousand times again. And I rise up, I like the waves. I rise up, in spite of the ache. I rise.
Support for Outbeat Radio on KRCBFM comes from listeners and from Rocky, the free-range chicken, and Rosie, the original organic chicken. Air-chilled, non-GMO, locally raised right here in Sonoma County with no antibiotics ever. More information is available at rockyandrosie.com. You're listening to 104.9 KRCBFM Roanoke Park and KRCGFM Windsor, Sonoma County's NPR station.
It's 9 p.m. Stay with us. LaJazz Hot is next.